Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the Raekwon Boreham murder trial is now in the hands of the jury. Dates are set for new elections in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District, and Republicans are lining up to run. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles may be getting heat here at home over her hesitancy to condemn ICE, but she's now in heady company in Washington as a member of the new American Workforce Policy Advisory Board. What's that? We'll tell you. And the governor unveils his budget priorities. Our roundtable of reporters is set to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAA News. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Glenn Berkins is back. He's the editor-publisher at QCityMetro.com. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV Eyewitness News. Hi to you.
Hello there.
And for the second time in a row, Jonathan Lowe is with us. He's reporter for Spectrum News. Good morning to you.
Howdy, Mike.
We're all on the radio. You can watch us on Facebook Live, except for Sarah D'Elia, who's going to kick us off. Sarah D'Elia is at the courthouse, where the Raekwon Boreham trial is underway, or it will be shortly. The trial went to the jury this week. They're being asked to consider three charges, Sarah: first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and possession of a firearm by a felon. Why both first- and second-degree murder?
Well, I think that kind of depends on who you ask. If you ask the state, they would argue that they've laid a good case to say that Raekwon Boreham, the night that Justin Carr was shot in Uptown Charlotte, that there was intention, that he intentionally went out with a gun, and that he had been chanting things negatively about the police, and that he had tried to fire his firearm once. It didn't go off. He tried to fire a firearm twice, and that shot was intended for police. That intent transferred to Justin Carr when he stepped in the line of fire and was ultimately hit. That's what the state would argue. The defense would say that they don't believe the state has made their case, that there was a shot that was fired that hit Justin Carr. If anything, they're arguing for a second-degree murder charge, which has more to do with mischief and less to do with the intent to go out there and actually shoot and kill someone that night. So that's a little bit about the differences between the two charges. And then the third charge, which no one is really arguing too much, is that possession of a firearm by a felon. It is well accepted that Raekwon Boreham is a felon, and there is some evidence that shows that he did have a firearm that night.
In fact, if I understand this correctly, the defense urged the jury that if they concluded that Boreham, in fact, fired the fatal shot, that they consider convicting him of second-degree murder. How unusual is it for the defense to suggest a charge?
That did perk up our ears in the courtroom, to be honest with you. I mean, I think it comes down to the severity of the first-degree conviction. If you are convicted of first-degree murder, you are going to prison for the rest of your life, and there is no possibility of parole. So I think that was sort of the defense's way of saying, okay, if you're going to convict him of something, please let it be the lesser of the two, so he has a chance to maybe get out of prison one day and have some kind of a life.
And, of course, Boreham, for those who are just joining us or just moving to Charlotte, Raekwon Boreham is accused of firing the gun that resulted in the death of Justin Carr. Both of them were at the disturbances uptown Charlotte on the second night following the police shooting of Keith Lamont Scott several years ago. On what did the prosecution hang their case? Because I know there's some video there. I'm not sure what it shows. What did they hang their case on?
So there was so much video that was shown. There was video that CMPD had attained from their real-time crime cameras that are around the city. But there was also a lot of video from people that were on the ground that night that were documenting what was going on in Charlotte. So they actually relied on that really heavily. There was some testimony from a man named Rashid Ali, who is a documentarian, and he goes to all sorts of kinds of protests all over the country, and he was there in Charlotte that night, and he did get some footage that it looks like it is Raekwon Boreham. It looks like there are a couple of his friends that he was there with that night, and he also captured the moments right after Justin Carr was shot, and that was some pretty graphic footage that was shown in the courtroom. He clearly has a head injury. He's clearly unconscious. That was played in front of Justin Carr's family as well. The other big piece of evidence that I feel the state is really heavily relying on is jailhouse calls.
Phone calls. Phone calls.
Yes, phone calls from the jailhouse that Raekwon Boram placed. So shortly after his arrest, he's in arrest processing, and he gets to make phone calls outside. And those calls are, of course, recorded, and they've been played in the courtroom. And during those calls, we don't know who is on the other line, but it sounds like he's speaking to a friend. And he says things like, they got me on the camera, I'm going down for this, I confess. So I feel like the state is really heavily relying on that testimony, that evidence as well.
Yeah, I keep hearing that we don't know who's on the other line in those calls, but do we know the number and who owns the number that he called?
So we do know that the number was he made four phone calls that they played, and it's all to the same number. It's unclear whether it's the same person that he's talking to or not. They really just don't know.
So this went to the jury, as I understand it, on Wednesday. Is that correct?
I believe so,
okay.
Yeah.
And all the days kind of run together, don't they?
Yes, they do.
And almost immediately, the jury had questions for the judge. What were they?
Yeah, so the jury wrote something that said photos, video, audio, ? And the judge was a little confused about what that meant exactly, so he brought them all in, and that meant that they wanted to review all of that evidence again. I should say that there are over 100 pieces of evidence that have been submitted in this trial. That's a lot of evidence, and the judge was, said, of course, you can look over anything that's already been submitted, but if you want to view that video, we're going to have to do that in real time in court because the technology just isn't there in the jury room. So they kind of came up with this compromise. The judge let them have transcripts of the calls from jail that Raekwon Boram had placed, as well as some interviews CMPD had done with a couple of witnesses, and gave them the photos that they could go back and look at. Those are photos from the scene of the crime. Those are photos that were taken at Boram's home, and those are photos, I believe, of Justin Carr as well.
So the jury deliberated all day yesterday, most of the day Wednesday, and they were sent home late last night, or at 5:30 or 6 o'clock last night, without reaching a verdict. So they're back this morning at around 9:30, and they're going right into the jury room to continue their deliberation. If he is found guilty, when would he be sentenced? Right then and there on the spot, or would they come back for a sentencing hearing?
Oh, no. I believe the Judge Hayes is ready to sentence when there's a verdict. I believe so. That's usually how it will work.
And what are the potential sentences?
Well, first degree would be life without the possibility of parole. Second degree murder, I've heard a couple of different things. I believe during his closing arguments, defense attorney Mark Simmons said it could be as high as 18 years in prison if it's second degree. The second degree kind of depends on which charges that are found within the second degree charge. That it kind of depends on a few things that the jury will have to decide. So it's still a significant amount of time in prison, but of course, it's not life without parole.
And the jury never knew that the judge in this case was threatened at some point during this trial. They never knew that. But did it play a role at all, do you think, as you watched the judge conduct this trial?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think what it did, when there were these conversations about if there was a threat against Judge Hayes, the jury has to leave the room. So what it did was it caused a delay, and it caused, all they tell the jury is, there's a legal matter that needs to be discussed. And then they're instructed, and don't think about what that legal matter could be. That's kind of hard. We're all inquisitive people. It'd be hard not to think about, well, what is going on? What is delaying proceedings so much? But Judge Hayes conducted himself, I thought, fairly well. He didn't let on in front of the jury that he was at all concerned about his well-being or anything like that. And if anything, he just kept hitting home, you are not to be looking at the media. This legal matter is being reported on the media. And stay away from social media. Stay away from the news as much as you possibly can.
WFAE Sarah D'Elia, who is covering the Raekwon Boram trial for us. She'll have the results when the verdict becomes available to us right here on WFAE. So stay with us. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
We're going to continue with the roundup. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. We've been following the goings-on in the 9th Congressional District since election night 2018, when the contest between Republican Mark Harris and Democrat Dan McCready was squeaky close. Harris declared victory. McCready conceded, but almost immediately questions arose about the suspicious activity surrounding election fraud, and the state elections board, as we all know, refused to certify the results. Several weeks ago, at that state elections board hearing to cover all this, Mark Harris said, "We need a new election." The board agreed. Now the dates for both the primary and the general have been set. What are they? Who wants to take that?
So the primary will be May 14th. Mm-hmm. The general election will be September 5th.
Okay.
And if
September 5th or September 10th?
10th, excuse me. If there is a second primary, mm-hmm. the general election will then be November 5th.
Dan McCready is so far alone in the Democratic side. Is that right? Is he
That's
likely
correct.
To face a challenge, or do you know? Has anybody even raised their...
See Christian Canoe throw his name in there again. He likes to run, but I haven't heard of a candidate emerge to
and
challenge
Dan
McCready.
You know, I think for the Republicans, so filing starts Monday and it's going to end on the 14th. Mm-hmm. So that means it's 2 months until the primary. That's going to be a real sprint because... it's only 2 months, but for Dan McCready, even if he gets an opponent, I think this is going to be kind of an easy stroll to winning in May.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mike.
No.
I was just going to say, the fact that there may be a second primary with there already being like five candidates on the Republican side, I could see that being a likely possibility.
I only had four. Who's the fifth?
Dean Arp just announced yesterday.
Okay, so the five candidates, and on Tuesday, former Mecklenburg County Commissioner Matthew Ridenour filed with the Federal Elections Commission. I think he might have been the first one.
I know that with my background and the skills and abilities I've gathered through my service in the Marine Corps and my 6 years as a county commissioner, I've got what it takes to go up there and get that job done.
That's Ridenour, who, as you heard, touted his Marine Corps credentials. That means we're going to have at least two Marines running for a while because Dan McCready is a Marine who also touts his Marine Corps credentials. Jonathan, you spoke with Ridenour. Did he expand on anything more than what he just said when he talked to you?
He did, and I'll use the tagline he came up with, "It takes a Marine to beat a Marine."
Good line. All right.
I'll give that to Matthew Ridenour. Okay. He will tell you that he served two tours of duty in Iraq. He has two kids, two years old and 18 months, I believe. And we all know that he's a former Mecklenburg County commissioner. He really touted, though, being able to, while he was on the commission, someone who, even though he is a conservative Republican, was able to work really well, even though there was a 6-3, and he was in the minority. So he really touted being, a member of the military, someone who will go to Washington, fight for the VA, which we all know is, for all intents and purposes, failing right now. Really spoke about the rising $22 trillion debt, wanting to do something about that, and immigration he brought up as well.
And so he's in the race now with four others. Stevie Rivenbark, who's a full-time mother from Fayetteville working in healthcare, is in the race. David Blackwelder, a Raleigh police officer, is running. And Boss Hogg, or at least someone who has posted Facebook pictures of himself as that TV character, Union County Commissioner Stoney Rushing, is also in the race. Who is this latest entrant?
I don't know much about Dean Arp, Joe.
I don't know much about him either. I also think that we might see another candidate emerge, either Tommy Tucker or Dan Bishop. I don't think they both will run. I do think one of them will.
Dan Bishop, the architect of HB2.
Yes, and former state senator Tommy Tucker. The thing to keep in mind here, 60% of the primary votes came from Union and Mecklenburg County. So those are the two counties that they're honing in on.
And would that help Stoney Rushing?
I think it would. He got more than 50,000 votes last election.
Yeah, if Matthew Ridenour and Dan Bishop both run for Mecklenburg, that's wonderful news for Stoney. Then he has Union County to himself and would probably be a favorite or strong contender.
A little more to talk about that. And, of course, Vile Isles goes to Washington. We'll talk about that, too, when we continue on Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. That explains all these reporters sitting around the table here. Joe Bruno from Channel 9, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Steve Harrison from WFAE News. We are told by our erstwhile producers that Dean Arp is a Union County State House member, a Republican serving his fourth term at the moment. He's the other entrant so far into the 9th District Republican race. A recent poll puts Dan McCready 4 points ahead of any Republican running, but there are lots of weeks before the primaries and months before the general. Should we read anything into that point advantage at this point?
It was pretty much in a margin of error, so I don't know. And, you know, some people have expressed, some Republicans have expressed to me that they thought Dan McCready would actually fare better than being pretty much within a margin of error, considering everything that just happened with Mark Harris.
Name recognition, yeah.
I think that this new race is going to be really interesting because a lot of the Republican candidates are going to try to force Dan McCready to take a position on issues, particularly Matthew Ridenour. He said, you know, for the fact that he's a Marine, just like Dan is, that takes away Dan McCready's talking point of saying, well, I'm a Marine, I'll put country over party. Ridenour really wants to harp in on McCready's views on things like the Green New Deal and other topics that have emerged in the House.
Glenn.
If I were McCready, I would not feel very good with a 4-point margin, given the fact that I do have name recognition and I spent so much money in the general last time. I think the other thing that's going to make this general election interesting is that it will not have the momentum of the election last fall, when we saw record numbers of people across the country turn out to vote. Donald Trump was on the ballot last November. Will that be repeated this coming November? We don't know what's going to happen.
But this seat's important to national Democrats. Mm-hmm. So will they be pumping money into this race because there's going to be a lack of enthusiasm to get people out to vote in the first place?
I think so. I mean, we have already seen some presidential candidates put out donation requests for Dan McCready. I know Seth Moulton, who's exploring a run, he's done so. Elizabeth Warren has done so. McCready's raised already $500,000 before a new election was called. I think he's going to run up that total, especially while he sits back and relaxes and watches the Republican take out each other.
I think I was just going to say, I think one thing about the race that'll be interesting is for whichever Republican wins, kind of how they handle the scandal. Stoney Rushing's view is that Mark Harris was wronged. He shouldn't have dropped out. He's not convinced really anything happened that in Bladen County that warranted a new election.
And Harris endorsed Stoney Rushing.
He did, yes.
And I'll add to that, Steve, that Matthew Ridenour, I asked him that specific question. He does believe that there was something that happened as far as election fraud.
How is this playing? Do people believe that there was fraud? Do people believe that Mark Harris was cheated? Do they believe that this is just nonsense to deny a Republican the seat? Or do they believe that this is something that's legitimate and there needs to be a new election? What are the people saying?
I think the people, for the most part, overwhelmingly think that something went wrong in the election. Some people believe that there was a little more fraud on one side than the other. And, you know, others think that, you know, everybody was doing it. And, you know, this kind of was a witch hunt. So there is still that belief. Stoney Rushing is one of those who believes that, you know, this was kind of orchestrated by former members of the Board of Elections.
But if you talk to voters in at least Union County, who is a Republican stronghold, some of them have told me they do believe that there was something that happened that needs to be investigated. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there is that belief in that part of this district. Who they feel is responsible, well, that's to be debated.
So the North Carolina Elections Board Executive Director Kim Strach, S-T-R-A-C-H, has given Wake County's district attorney documents and information from the state's probe of the absentee mail fraud in Bladen and Robeson counties, which was the epicenter, of course, of this scandal. Wake County's district attorney Lauren Freeman described the document dump as voluminous, but she told WFAE the investigation is underway.
We'll start to consider what charges are appropriate, not only for, you know, Mr. Dallas, but also, you know, others who may have been involved, both from a standpoint of working as part of the operation, but also, you know, what if any additional individuals who are involved with financing the operation may face any kind of criminal culpability.
She mentioned McCray Dallas, who is at the center of all this. He has been charged. What did they charge him with?
Obstruction,
possession of an absentee ballot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and those charges stemmed from the 2018 primary and the 2016 general, and not the 2018 general. Why not? And Is the Wake County District Attorney now looking into the 2018 general?
Yes. Now that she has all the documents from the State Board of Elections, she's going to start going through the 2018 general. And a lot of people have been saying, you know, what about this person? What about this person? Why haven't they been charged? The fact of the matter is the District Attorney didn't have the documents. She was running a parallel investigation. And I think she really wanted the State Board of Elections to be able to have this hearing without the criminal side of this looming over it.
How many people have been charged so far?
Five.
Are they people that worked for McRae Dowless? Is that who they are?
Yes.
Are more arrests or charges likely to come?
Yes.
All of this would be for naught, of course, if precautions weren't being taken to safeguard the integrity of the new primary and the new general election. And North Carolina Elections Director Kim Stratch says they are on it.
Because of the issues that we saw in Bladen County and Robeson County, and the fact that both Bladen County and Robeson County do not have currently have a director of elections, they have interims that are there, we think it is extremely important that our staff, be on the ground in Bladen and Robeson County throughout this process, ensuring that their training and basically all aspects of election preparation are being done with our oversight.
I'm going to have to buy that reporter a new mic cable. Okay, on to other news. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles went to Washington this week because she has been appointed to the American Workforce Policy Advisory Board. What is that? That's an initiative of the Trump administration created by executive order and led by presidential daughter and advisor Ivanka Trump and Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross. Lyles is the only U.S. mayor to have been named to this board. Why her?
I'm sure it has something to do with RNC.
The Republican National Convention. They like her. They really like
her. They really like her. Absolutely.
I think in The Observer, I think there was a quote from Ivanka Trump to the mayor saying how I can't remember the exact quote, but so many cities wanted the convention and you want it. It's going to be great.
Congratulations.
And, of course, no other city
exactly.
wanted the convention. No. it's just kind of an aside.
when President Trump was here for the Mark Harris rally, I had a couple minutes to interview him. And one thing he told me was, you have a great mayor. President Trump knows who Vi Lyles is, and he really does like her.
Okay. She's on this board with some really heavy hitters, including Apple CEO Tim Cook. Tim Apple, yes, because he sat next to the president at the announcement of this, and he called him Tim Apple. Was that a mistake, or is that just a shorthand nickname for him now? The CEOs of Lockheed Martin, Siemens USA, Visa USA, Walmart, Home Depot, IBM, as well as several state governors and presidents of universities and colleges. Might some of these business associations prove to be valuable to Charlotte going forward? I mean, they meet the mayor, they get to know her. Bring a headquarters here.
It doesn't hurt, I'm sure. At the end of the day, companies make business decisions based on business reasons, not because of personal relationships. But it doesn't hurt. Could these associations lead a CEO to look at Charlotte where maybe before it might not have? Absolutely.
So what does this board, what is it going to do? It's brand new, hasn't done anything yet, but the American Workforce Policy Advisory Board, what's the function of this group?
Yeah, that's kind of a good question. Most of the coverage that came out of the meeting was about the president calling Tim Cook Tim Apple. So we didn't hear a lot of substance to actually come out of it.
God bless the media.
They're supposed to be looking at, skills programs and getting people more into trade jobs.
I know that Lou Dobbs got very upset about this. He thinks it's a tragedy and it shouldn't be allowed. I've forgotten his reasoning, quite honestly, but you can Google it.
I think he said some of the CEOs, you know, that he felt like it was this like globalist, a lot of CEOs with this global vision, and so it wasn't going to be America's first.
And he took the president to task for this. He's a big supporter of President
right,
Trump.
Yeah.
He took the president to task for this.
I couldn't follow his reasoning. I read it, and I just couldn't follow why he was so opposed to it.
Spectrum News talked with Mayor Vi Lyles outside the White House. Here's what she said about their work.
We want to make sure everybody has an opportunity to thrive. And right now, we know that that's not happening. We've got a lot of great paying jobs, and we've got a lot of people that want to work. So we've got to connect them with those jobs.
The mayor will be on this program next Thursday. We will talk more about this with her at that time. We're also likely to talk about the troubles she faced recently from members of the community over the city's reluctance to stand up to ICE. At a recent city council meeting, things got a little raucous as activists criticized her for not condemning federal immigration raids. And on Monday, the mayor released a letter to the community addressing the issue, in which she also said this.
I believe words alone are not enough. We are committing to action by dedicating time and resources to help our immigrant community. Words must be coupled with intentional action as we build solutions together.
What reaction has that letter received, if any?
It's a start. I believe a lot of people were hoping to hear from the mayor, to basically say, here, listen, we hear your concerns. We understand the impact that these arrests are having in the community. The letter itself, aside from that, didn't have a whole lot new. She stressed that Charlotte's a welcoming city no matter where you're from, and she stressed that CMPD does not work with ICE on these measures. All of those things, though, continuously come up.
I think what some of her critics fail to realize is that she's not a pure play politician. Mm-hmm. She cut her teeth in government.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, she's very pragmatic about these things. She's probably a bit more cautious than some who are pure politicians. Some politicians, going back to our last segment, some Democratic politicians may not have wanted to be on Trump's workforce committee. Our mayor saw it as a good thing, apparently. So I think that's one of the things that her critics don't understand.
Well, Joe, you reported that she said that she hopes that the letter shows she's taking a stronger stance on immigration concerns in Charlotte. Does the letter show that? Does it demonstrate that in some way?
It shows that they recognize the impact that this is all having, but it does not take a strong stance against ICE. It's not overly critical of the federal government. And I think that the mayor is trying to be really careful here, because I don't think she wants to risk angering ICE and then making it worse for this community.
And when this all started, that is one of the things we heard from everybody in the audience, was take a specific stance. Yeah. And take a side. And she's not going to take a side, as we've seen her.
And Steve, you have reported that in the past the city has taken a bolder position on immigration, and Vide Lyles was part of it when she was on city council.
Yeah, if you go back to 2015, they had this civil rights resolution, and they had some pretty strong language about how CMPD would not enforce federal immigration laws. And kind of came out and said it very clearly, like, this is not what we do. Even if we find out or have suspicion someone is in the country illegally, we're not really concerned with that. That started a huge backlash in Raleigh. And ever since then, the city has really kind of kept its head down. Mm-hmm. On this issue, it is not wanting to get involved.
So prior to the criticism that she and the city received a couple of weeks ago about their handling of ICE, the mayor had announced that she was forming a committee to seek input. The Immigrant Community Committee is still a go. In fact, I believe they met, or portions of them met, this week. Joe, you refiled the story, I think it was yesterday.
Yes.
That Charlotte City Council's newly formed Immigration Committee actually held a private, unadvertised meeting. Why is this a problem?
It violates open meetings laws. I mean, listen, immigration, this issue has continuously come up in City Hall. We've seen people pack the chamber, passionate pleas to City Council. Had we known about this meeting, it would have been well attended by the public and the media. Yeah. People want to know what their council members are discussing about this topic.
Why did they do it this way?
So it was yeah.
That's number one. And number two, did they know that they were breaking the law?
Their city council member, I think they had to have known. Right. I think an intern knows that this is wrong. But
because the chair of this committee was Larkin Eggleston, Dimple Esmero was there, James Mitchell and Matt Newton were there, Vi Lyles and Braxton Winston and staff were also there. But you reported that you were told that Tariq Bakari and Julie Iselt tried to attend, but were told they could not. Why not?
Because they did not want there to be a quorum.
Would that have made it more illegal?
It would have, but they already had quorum, because this is the entire Immigration Committee meeting. I mean, it's just like the Economic Development Committee meeting, the Budget Committee meeting. All four members were present. And then one other thing I want to mention, Dimple Esmero and Braxton Winston did raise their voices in the meeting. They said, hey, listen, I think the public should be here.
Okay. But evidently minutes were not taken.
Minutes were not taken.
So how do we know that?
I asked for a copy of the minutes, and I was told
that.
So
how do we
taken.
Know that, that Braxton raised his objections to having nobody
Oh,
here?
Sources told me that, and then Braxton and Dimple did confirm that to me individually, and they actually provided statements for the article.
And I'll say one, add one more thing, Mike. I've covered the city for about 10 years, and in that time, I think that I haven't seen the city have kind of the transparency issues and problems that they have now during that whole time. I mean, there's just very – I think a lot of us would agree there's a difficulty in getting records, in getting interviews. It's just – and so I'm not sure, like, how this committee, how it went sideways with this meeting, but it's not unusual or not surprising in the last year or two.
Does the chair of the committee, Larkin Eggleston, make the decision to do what was done, or is that the decision of the mayor?
It seems like everybody's pointing a finger at somebody. Some are saying that Larkin, this falls on Larkin. Others says it falls on the city for not notifying people. And then others are saying, you know, listen, this should have been the mayor who stepped in.
Did anything come out of this meeting?
From what I understand, it was planning, but also that some policy proposals were introduced.
Okay. This committee, notwithstanding, what can a city actually do in the face of federal law and federal law enforcement?
That's a good question. I think that the city can, you know, of course, reiterate that CMPD does not cooperate with ICE. But I also think that it comes down to reassuring the public, reassuring the immigrant community that they can reach out to the city and have help with their services. And nobody's going to be asking, like, what your citizenship status is, if okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
When we come back, there's one more thing that the city council actually did this week, which we'll talk about, and that's aging in place and how that affects elderly people and who are on fixed incomes, and also the county commission looking at the possibility of floating a bond for land for schools and land for parks, and that would necessitate raising taxes. What? And the transit plan has hit a little opposition here. The way the line is being projected. Oh, I have a whole minute left. I thought we were coming up to the break. Well, we'll talk about very quickly about this city council aging in place. It was a plan to invest $500,000 into a new pilot program. What is that program?
So basically, this is help for senior citizens, low-income senior households who just got those revaluations in the mail. As we know, the average for a senior household was about 66% of an mm-hmm. increase in the assessed value of their home. So people can who qualify, you can't make under 30, you have to make at least $30,200 as a household. And you could get help between $100 and $1,000. The key thing to remember here is the county has a homestead program. You cannot double dip.
Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back. And in the break, I will learn how to tell time. It's Charlotte Talks. Okay, I've synchronized my watch. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe, reporter for Spectrum News, is here, as is Joe Bruno from WSSC-TV Eyewitness News and Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro. We were talking just before the break about City Council's Aging in Place program. Is this getting talked about now and funding because of the impending tax revaluation and its impact, its potential impact on elderly people?
That's correct. It all has to do with the whole affordable housing crisis. As we know, there are a lot of seniors in the community, low income, fixed income, who are probably going to have a hard time with the revaluation. I think these folks were up in the Cornelius area, but an African-American couple up there, elderly, have been living up there by the lake for decades, since I believe 1940-something. They now have $1 million home, and I remember they paid $46,000 for it. So there's going to be a problem with the seniors in our community who cannot afford when they finally get the tax bill later this summer.
Right.
And so they can get some help from either the city of Charlotte or the county, but not both. So it's important to remember there are some great programs out there that can give people some help, but you can't double
dip. So there'll be more details on that coming.
Yeah, the council, I was just going to add one more thing. The council allocated $500,000 in the prior budget, and some of them on the council asked about, is there a possibility, could we allocate another $500,000 in the next budget? The city manager, Marcus Jones, said that by all means they can do that. It's just
where are they going to find it?
Glenn.
The double whammy for this has to do as well with gentrification. In some of these low-income neighborhoods, especially those that are close in, housing values are going up because of gentrification. Right. People are moving in, driving up those property values. And the city is looking at ways it can keep long-term residents in those neighborhoods in place, many of whom are being pushed out by a number of forces related to gentrification.
So on Wednesday, Mecklenburg County commissioners said they voted to study a new bond to provide hundreds of millions of dollars to buy land for parks and greenways and schools. We know we are underparked in this area. We know that the Cross Charlotte Trail is short $77 million. What are they studying?
So a $300 million bond. The vice chair, Elaine Powell, has said that we need to get ahead of the rate at which investors are gobbling up public land to build the apartments, the condos, and so
if we don't act now, the land will be gone or more expensive. Is that
correct,
what they're saying?
Correct. Well, she's saying it'll just be gone.
Okay.
And so the idea is study it, $300 million bond put on the upcoming November ballot. But there are two things. Firstly, Commissioner Pat Cotham and
Vilma Leek.
Sorry, voted, I'm having
voted,
a moment.
It's okay. Voted no.
Having a moment. Brain fart.
Wait till you get old.
voted no against it, saying, you know, they just don't want to tax the people in their district. The county commission is also, though, looking at a $50 million bond.
50?
Yes. Because the Arts and Science Council came before them maybe 3 weeks ago saying, you know, we're struggling right now. Could you put this half-cent sales tax, raise $50 million, we would get 20,
yeah,
and then the county commission decides what to do with
it. It's not a bond. It's an increase in the sales tax.
Yes.
We're talking about rising property taxes with a reval. We're talking about this $300 million bond that they'd like to float, but that will cause – it doesn't fit in with the amount of money they have to pay back debt.
But so it could raise taxes.
So they'd have to raise taxes, and then there's quarter-cent sales tax.
Yeah, one of the purposes of the study is to figure out how they would pay for this $300 million bond. And now you have to keep in mind it's a triple whammy. If we have to raise taxes for this, and then we have the sales tax for the Arts and Science Council, then we have property revaluation, which the chair of the board has already said there's a slim to none chance that we're going revenue neutral. So there's three right there if they all come down. And I think that's why there's some hesitancy from people like Pat Cotham and Vilma Leek.
And I'll say probably there's probably four coming down at some point because Katz wants to finish the 2030 transit plan. That's going to be another sales tax increase. So I think especially with the arts and science, the proposed quarter cent tax, those are the ones that'll be fighting, you know, between transit and the arts.
Well, I'm glad you brought the transit plan up because there's no money for that at the moment. They have this very ambitious plan that takes the new train, whatever color it is, it's the Silver Line.
Silver, that's right.
It, from Matthews to the airport and then ultimately to Belmont, and people in Gastonia are now saying they want it to go to Gastonia as well. And there's some disagreement right now over the route that they have chosen because it doesn't come through uptown.
That's right. So the plan is that the train will come along Independence Boulevard, and as it gets close to uptown, it will then follow I-277 and then 11th Street, which is at the very top end of uptown. And there's some concern that not having a stop closer to uptown is just going to make it where people don't want to ride it because either you have to walk 15 minutes to get into the heart of the center city.
But let's be clear.
Or change trains.
It does connect with the blue line.
That's right.
Correct? Now anybody who's ridden the subway anywhere in the world knows that not everything connects downtown. Let's use the D.C. subway as an example. All the different color lines connect at Metro Center, which is in the center of the district. But you don't have to necessarily go to Metro Center to get from Silver Spring to Alexandria. You can change from the red line to the blue line at some place outside and get there. What's the difference?
So I think the big difference is that in Washington, D.C., a lot of people are – it's your car commute is going to take 50 minutes or an hour. And so changing trains and adding another 10 minutes to your trip is not a big deal, right? It's still faster to take the train here. You can drive in from Matthews and probably park 30-35 minutes. So if you have to get off the Silver Line, walk to the Blue Line, wait for a train, take another train, it's I think in 100 years maybe it's not a big deal. In the next 10 years, the worry is that it's just not going to be attractive to people to take.
They keep building those apartments and raising the congestion and the density.
Then yes, then it will be awful enough that.
and I think it's more than just convenience as well. It's parking. It's the price of parking.
Right.
Parking in D.C., these other places, very high. Expensive. So people are willing to transfer.
They brought this up in the budget committee, too. It's looking like $8 million. They asked the CEO, John Lewis of Katz, do we have a funding source for this? Do we have any idea how we're going to pay for it? And Lewis was like, as of now, we're assuming the federal government's going to provide 50% of that, but really all we can do is go with that assumption.
Okay. In his first 2 years of office, Governor Roy Cooper had a solidly Republican legislature to deal with who had no intention of taking any of his budget proposals seriously, but the GOP has lost their supermajority. Does that mean that at least some of the proposals that he revealed this week will be not only considered but perhaps adopted or at least partially adopted or changed in some way and then adopted? Will they have to pay attention to him?
They do have to pay attention, yeah, for the first time, right? And his budget, I think, called for, I think teachers would get 9.1% over 2 years. Republicans said they didn't feel like that was particularly realistic.
Plus, they've already given teachers a pay. The Republicans will tell you they've given teachers pay raises for several consecutive years, right?
That's right. And there was also, again, in the budget, more talk about a school bond. And I think the governor's made, I can't remember the statistics, but he talked about how X percent of North Carolina schools are over 50 years old, in trying to make the case there. I think that's interesting just because I think, you know, a school being 50 years old doesn't necessarily mean it's obsolete.
Right.
Like if it's up to date, if it's been taken care of, if it's got technology, I think that's fine. Yeah. But
so he thinks, the governor thinks, that he does have a shot at some of the things in his budget.
At some point, we're going to have to work together to come to consensus on this budget. There's going to have to be give and take. I know I won't get everything that I've asked for in this budget, but I do believe that there is leverage so that the legislature can do some of these things.
So in addition to the pay raises for teachers and other state employees that he's suggesting, the governor also wants the state to expand Medicaid. This has been a problem since the McCrory administration and since the inception of the Affordable Care Act, which depended in large part on expanding Medicaid in states. And McCrory always said, our system is broken here, we can't afford it, and we can't predict what it will cost once the sunset clause in the Affordable Care Act goes away. So is Cooper likely to get his wish? Has anything changed?
It seems like the House is willing to negotiate on Medicaid. There seems to be some support in the Republican side of the House, but I think the holdup right now is the Senate. And something that's interesting is Governor Cooper has not said whether he would take a budget without Medicaid expansion. He hasn't shown whether he would accept that.
He's also said it's critical to the future of North Carolina to expand Medicaid. Has he explained why? Or do we know why?
I think he's just trying to provide health care for the lowest income of North Carolina residents.
And he called once again, among other things, for tuition-free community college. That's been rebuffed in the past by the legislature. Does he have a better shot? What would that cost to give tuition-free community college to people? Okay.
A lot of money.
I've stumped the panel. Dollar Tree, which brought homegrown Family Dollar stores in 2015, is planning to close as many as 390 Family Dollar stores this year, rebranding another 200 under the Dollar Tree name. I suppose this was inevitable, but I didn't take business classes in school, so why would you spend all that money to buy a company and then shut it down?
Good question. I think they're trying to scale back and turn into a weird dollar grocery store.
Oh,
with what they're closing 390 stores, but then 1,000 of them, they're going to either rebrand or some of them are going to be turned into. They're going to start selling alcohol. Some of them are going to have a specific $1 Dollar Tree section. They're going to add to the freezers and cooler sections in some stores. So it's a weird kind of closing stores, reorganizing.
So 390 stores is a lot of stores. How many of them are in the Charlotte area? How many local people are affected by employment? Employees are affected.
We don't know specifically how many here locally. Of course, Dollar Tree owns Family Dollar, which is based in Indian Trail or Matthews area.
Right.
it's remains to be seen which stores here in the Charlotte area will be rebranded to Dollar Tree and which ones will be closed.
So, Joe, you reported this week on something kind of unusual, a very strange story about a man who wants to be a YouTube star in the worst way, and it turns out this is the worst way to become a YouTube star. Explain.
It's called a constitutional auditor.
Never heard that term. What does that mean?
He basically tests the Second Amendment and open carry laws. And the way he has been doing this is he brings a gun on his hip and openly carries a gun outside police stations and police headquarters. He tried this in January at CMPD, and he was swarmed by officers. He recorded the whole interaction, and police didn't take him into custody, warned him not to do this again. He voluntarily left. Well, he decided to come back this week. Police saw him on the camera doing the same thing. They swarmed him. This time, he didn't get a warning, though. They took him into custody. You can't have a gun outside CMPD headquarters. It's against city ordinance. Of course, also, the security is so heightened at CMPD headquarters because last year, officers were ambushed there. Right. So it's a safety concern for them.
But did he have was he licensed to have an open carry weapon with him?
I believe so, yes. And the police made it clear it didn't matter if he had bullets in the gun or not. You just can't have a weapon outside police headquarters.
So as I understand what you're saying here is this guy is trying to capture on camera for YouTube and I guess for society at large how police departments react to people by provoking them?
Yes.
Is that against the law?
Well, that's a good question. In the video that he recorded in January, the officer's like, you're just trying to provoke us. You're just trying to get us to mess up. And he basically is like, yeah, I am, for the lawsuit.
What a guy. Okay, on the night before Audrey Kell High School was scheduled to play West Charlotte in a state quarterfinals boys basketball game, Audrey Kell removed one of their top players. He posted a racial slur about West Charlotte on Snapchat. That's an app on which posts are supposed to disappear quickly. Evidently, it didn't disappear quickly enough. Is that what happened here?
Someone who he sent it to screenshotted it.
Oh. And the racial slur was essentially about going to the hood and playing black people in a very negative
way. Targeted at West Charlotte.
Yeah. So this surfaced over the weekend, and on Monday night, a second Snapchat post featured a prominent member of the West Charlotte team threatening to shoot the Audrey Kell player who wrote the first post. This post turned out not to be authentic. How did they determine that?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I think you stumped us again.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's my job. It's what I do. Well, and I don't know the answer to that question. So unlike a lawyer, I don't raise.
All I know is that the school system said that it was a hoax. And Okay.
So evidently this incident galvanized the West Charlotte team. Here's what player Patrick Williams said.
These last couple of days have brought us closer together as a team, as a community. Today we got to see how much West Charlotte supports us, just how much they love us. So going on throughout the playoffs, when we put this jersey on, we know that we got people behind us supporting us.
And they won the game. The community also rallied behind.
Absolutely. The racial slur was only part of the story. The other part was that because the West Charlotte gymnasium is so small, they had to move the game to a neutral site. Ordinarily, the higher-ranked team would host that game. And so some in that community, some West Charlotte grads, felt slighted. Mm-hmm. And so these two things happened at the same time. They're moving the game away from West Charlotte, which some people said was racially motivated. There's no evidence that it was. And then on top of that, you had the racial slur.
So I was at the game. It's interesting they moved it for space because people had to be turned away out advance. The superintendent Wilcox saying that they're now going to look into finding spaces where they can handle these large crowds.
Here's what else he said.
Just a sense of sadness that a kid would do this, that particularly an athlete who had other black athletes on his team, that he felt somehow compelled to say something like this.
And we'll leave it with that. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV News, and Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and earlier Sarah D'Elia covering the Raekwon Boram trial for us on Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.